Donna Lindo, Reel 3.
My father had been on to me for ages to try for a commission, and after a lot of thought and argument, I agreed to go and have a go. So I applied to the WAF officer and was sent up to the Air Ministry to go through it all. I wasn't really very interested because it meant that I wouldn't be able to drive anymore, but I thought I'd better sort of please him, and so off I went. It was really rather a farce because I arrived with my buttons and gleaming, everything pressed and beautifully polished, and this whole row of WAF and RAF officers, all the high brass, sitting in a row, and you have to walk in, salute. They tell you to sit down, you put your cap on the table with the badge facing them, and a whole lot of old rubbish, but anyway. And then they've got all your details in front of them. And one of them asked me, "Oh, you come from Portugal?" So I said, "Yes." "And what sort of animals do you keep and have in Portugal?" And really, I mean, I couldn't believe that this was true, because, I mean, you long to answer that they've got four legs, on one on each corner, and that's it, but you daren't. But I just couldn't believe that somebody was asking such a stupid question. Anyway, the only commission they could offer me was in balloon command, and I didn't want to be a balloon officer, so I explained why I didn't want to be one, and so I was returned to my unit as being unsuitable, which was fine. And strange enough, just after that, I was promoted to leading aircraft woman, which was much more exciting, and to have a little propeller on your arm was much better than having a silly old commission, so I was quite happy. And there I remained at that rank for the next 3 or 4 years.
How did your work change, or did it change?
After my promotion.
No,
not really, except you tended to get a slightly better car and the sort of went up in the pecking order, but other than that, and another, I think, 5 shillings a week, you didn't really change very much.
Would you like to describe any AOC's inspection?
Well, our AOC was an air commodore, and he was at the headquarters of the command that that time was in Bath. And we had a notice that he was coming round to inspect all some of the balloon sites. So everything was polished to the nines, and as I knew all the balloon sites, I was told that I had to lead the convoy. And he duly arrived, and off we set, and his big black car with the flag flying, with me in the front. And anybody knowing Bristol, there's lots of little streets and side streets and up and down streets, and anyway, we were sailing along, having been to various sites, and suddenly I looked in the mirror and there was no AOC behind. So what to do? Anyway, I thought we can't have got far, so I rushed round various streets and ended up coming out just in front of them, so all was well. Nobody ever said anything. Whether they noticed, I've no idea, but the inspection went all right anyway.
Did you spend Christmas in the camp?
Yes, I spent Christmas there. It was really rather good fun, because it was would be my second Christmas, I suppose, in the RAF, and a lot of the people there, stationed there, lived in Bristol, so they lived out. So it was agreed that they could have Christmas Day off, and we would be very big-hearted and do the work for them. So that we collected a lot of stuff for Christmas, and the hut became the dining hut, which was really a big missing hut. We decorated with greenery and a Christmas tree, which we got from somewhere. And we became very adept at making Christmas things, baubles for the tree. We used to wrap up things in silver paper from the cigarette packets, and it really looked very festive. And the food and lunch was absolutely amazing, because the officers all served the lunch, and the MO carved the turkey, and the CO served everything. We had proper sort of food, really. We had turkey, we had pork, we had bags of vegetables and Christmas pudding and all sorts of things we hadn't seen for years and years, because our staple diet seemed to be spam and beetroot, I think. But it was all a great success, and then they We had a sort of impromptu concert and all the officers made fools of themselves, but it was all in good fun, really.
What festive drink did you have?
Oh, well, we had beer, mostly, and we didn't really have any spirits, because I don't think anybody could afford them, but there were bags of beer. And also, at that time, the CEO had a wonderful red open Mercedes Benz, which he'd brought back from France. It had come back a labelled spares, I think. And when he was evacuated in 1940, he brought it back with him. And it really was a beautiful car, and I was allowed to drive it when I was his driver. And the done thing on Christmas Day was for him to go around a lot of the sites and say Happy Christmas to everybody, but of course you can't have a drink with all the sites when you're trying to get round them. So it had to be rationed, but it was a very good fun, and it was a smashing car, that, my goodness.
What sort of things did you do for fun? Did you have dances? And
yes, we had dances. We had to go down to one of the flight headquarters for dances, because they had quite a big sort of, I suppose, some village hall they'd taken over. And we had flight dances and squadron dances. And mostly we used to walk across the downs, so that there was a very good little pub across the downs we used to go, because we couldn't afford very much, and we used to have beer and play darts and things. We went to a lot of concerts at Coast and Hall, where they had sort of well-known bands like Geraldo, and all these bands used to come down, and we used to get in very cheaply in uniform. So we really had a bit of culture as well as the rest of it, I think.
Did you get to meet the opposite sex very much?
Oh yes, well, we all worked together, really, I think. You know, we all had our boyfriends. I had a boyfriend who was one of the dispatch riders. I don't think anybody really thought that anybody was any other sex. You know, all the drivers were drivers. Most of the men were mostly dispatch riders, and the girls were sort of the lorries and things. But we all got on so well, and there were only about 8 of us all together, so there weren't very many.
Did you meet your boyfriend there in Bristol?
Yes, he picked me up at the station when I arrived there first in a motorcycle sidecar. And we had a lot of fun all the summer, because he was there and we were able to go out and sort of around the countryside, you know.
Were there any Americans stationed around?
Well, the Americans started arriving, I mean, they came into the war in December of 1941, so I suppose they started arriving during the summer of 1942, I suppose, and they were stationed in Bristol and various places. Of course, they were frightfully smart and had lots of money and wore funny uniforms and things, but the problem really to start off with was that the blacks and the whites didn't get on very well together, and resulting in awful fights at night when they were out. So it was decreed that by their officers, I suppose, that the blacks would be out one night and the whites out the next, which really was a bit ridiculous, as we were all fighting the same war. But it took a few months to get them sort of organized so that they could live together, and the blacks actually were extremely nice, but of course they all, if they went out, you met them at a dance, they gave you cigarettes and nylons and stuff you hadn't seen for young. While I was at Bristol, I'd already mentioned I was met by this dispatch rider, and he and I eventually became engaged to each other. I think we hadn't got any money, but we thought we might as well perhaps become engaged. But it really sort of didn't last long as such, because in November of 1943, I was posted to balloon headquarters in Stanmore, and he was posted to the Middle East. We continued to be great friends, but we decided we wouldn't do anything about anything for the moment, and it sadly fizzled out in the end, but we remained good friends. And my next posting was to balloon headquarters, which was at Stanmore, which was where I've been trying to get near London for 3 years, I think, but anyway, I finally made it. And of course, I didn't want to leave Bristol very much by then, but anyway, you have to go where you're sent. And it was quite near to Virginia Wharton, and I could go on my days off. And this was the headquarters of the whole of Balloon Command. It was quite small, actually. It was attached to a balloon maintenance station, but we actually only had about 6 girls drivers, and that was all, and then the rest was, we used the facilities on the big camp. We lived in houses, just down the road and had another house as the mess hall, so it was all very civilised, really.
What sort of thing did you have for entertainment there?
Well, there we were quite lucky because we could go into London on the tube to, and go to anything there, or the big camp, which literally was next door, had its cinema, and it had big hangar where I played quite a lot of badminton, and it had all the facilities of a really big station, so we didn't have to go very far, and it was cheaper to go next door than go to London.
Did you get back to see your aunt and uncle very much?
Yes, I got back, because we used to have a day off once a week, usually. And then if you weren't on duty, you could go, because MT drivers have a knack of getting out of church parade, because you can always invent a trip of some sort. So quite often, if everybody else was on church parade, I could pop down there. Just after I sort of got there, I was acquired a... I suppose it must be the first ever made moped, I don't know, but it was an amazing machine with pedals and also a little engine on the back wheel. And it was in a terrible state, but the boys in the MT section got intrigued with it and they made it all work. It was never very reliable, but you could pedal if it got stuck. And I used to sort of pop down to Virginia Water on it. I don't think I ever got there without much trouble, but you had to blow through the petrol pump if it got bummed up, but it worked. And so I did get down quite often too, just for the day or for never much more until I went on leave.
Did you have a big birthday around that time?
Yes, in December of 1943, I became 21, and my aunt and uncle said that they would give me a party in London, which was, of course, wonderful. I hadn't got any clothes to wear, so I said, well, I'll have to come in uniform. So they said, that's okay. Anyway, I went down to London, and they'd arranged a lovely dinner at the restaurant called the Hungaria with them and a cousin and two chaps. So we were six altogether. Anyway, we had a lovely dinner. We danced, and then a wonderful surprise, they'd arranged me to stay the night in the Cumberland Hotel, which was absolutely marvellous, and sort of huge, great bathroom with all the sort of lovely soaps and towels all fluffed up. So I had a wonderful time, and the staff were marvellous, because I had to leave the hotel the next morning about 7 o'clock to get back to camp, and they even bought me breakfast in the bedroom, which was really something. It was a wonderful party, and really enjoyed it.
Did you have any special friends accompanying you around that time to your party?
Well, I didn't have any friends from camp, no. Mm-hmm. I had a good friend there called Nora, who she and I became buddies, but it was really a sort of just a family party, the birthday party. But Nora and I used to do quite a lot together, and when we were off duty together. But as there were only six girls, quite often you were not on off duty at the same time, because, you know, there wasn't a lot of people to do it.
Would you like to talk about some of the duties you had around that time?
Well, we're talking really sort of, I suppose, beginning of 44, things were beginning to build up for the invasion, which everybody thought was going to come sometime. And we were very busy sort of because the whole of the build-up was being done all on the south coast of England and everything, and we used to have to go and inspect things, because they still had balloons around stations, and the towns like Southampton and Portsmouth still had barrage balloons and things which we had to go and inspect. And also there was sort of weird things going on when they were sort of inspecting strange places in fields and things which we weren't sure what they were. But anyway, we just went out. I mean, we used to drive really hundreds of miles all sort of, and we practically all of us had our favourite offices we liked to drive. And so you could fiddle it, really, and nobody much wanted to drive the WAF officers because they were so snooty, usually. But the men were very nice, and we wanted our favourites, so we managed to fiddle that, really. The only trouble was that the corporal, WAF corporal, who was in charge of the section had the same boyfriend as one of the drivers, which was always made a little tricky. Well, I can do that bit about when I went to run the corporal's course too.
Right. Okay.
Well, I'll do the bit about the invasion first. During this time, I mean, the whole of the build-up to before D-Day, the whole of southern England was miles and miles of tanks and lorries and every conceivable sort of vehicle hidden amongst trees in camouflage, and of course a tremendous lot of camps around with a lot of Americans and Canadians and everybody. And there were also some weird structures being built, sort of huge concrete blocks, which we didn't know what was at the time, but it turned out that they were parts of the Mulberry Harbour, which were towed across the channel to make sort of piers and things for the stuff to be unloaded. But it was amazing. Then because the trees were in early leaf, they didn't show, because there's anybody bombed all that. There was a huge amount of stuff. But it was really exciting. You had to sort of show your identity card every few miles, and we really learned quite a lot of stuff, I think, really. Just about sort of this time, just before all that sort of started, I was ordered to go on a corporal's course at Cardington, which is in Bedfordshire. And I didn't really want to be a corporal very much, because get there again, a corporal doesn't do so much driving, but I had to go. And Cardington is a place where they had the huge hangars where they built the airships, the R-101 and the R-100. Amazing place. And I went on this corporal's course and quite enjoyed it. A lot of marching and stuff, and polishing. And on the final parade, I was sort of standing there. We were waiting to be inspected by the officer. And I sort of sneaked a look along the line, and it just happened to be somebody I'd known all my life from Portugal, who was the section officer in charge of all this. So I didn't know what to do quite, so I sort of stood very still, and she sort of came up and inspected me, and sort of looked me in the eye and whispered out of the corner of her mouth, "Meet you in the pub at 8 o'clock in Bedford." So, but it was amazing, really, to think that she was inspecting me, and I'd known her forever, and we had a great fun. I mean, she was obviously an officer and I wasn't, but we had a lovely time chatting about the war and stuff. Her husband had started off as a sergeant observer, but so they couldn't sort of be on the same station because she was an officer, but eventually he got a commission, so they were all right, and he was able to be posted with her.
There must have been a lot of troops around the time, you know.
Oh, absolutely amazing. I mean, there were huge camps and tents everywhere. I mean, the whole of, I would think, between, I don't know, perhaps Southampton and Kent, really, was huge, great tented camps of Americans, Canadians, everybody you can think of. And they weren't allowed out of camp either. It was very strictly run, you know, sort of. And then, of course, they had practices on down in the West Country on the beaches, sort of landing stuff, which... It was really quite a time, you know. One can't imagine, or people can't imagine what it was like unless you saw it, I think.
So some of the uniforms that you saw, as well as British, would have been, what, American, Canadian?
Yes, there was Americans, there were Canadians, there were French, there were Poles, practically everybody who was on our side, really, and all mixing together. And the Americans did tend to be a bit more on their own, because they were, when it came to the invasion, they actually were landed on different beaches to the others. But they all seemed to mix up all right, but they did keep a bit separate. But I think because of their landing beaches were a bit further down the coast.
Was it around this time that all leave was cancelled?
Yes, so we had leave was cancelled, I suppose. I mean, D-Day was on in June. I suppose leave was cancelled about March, I think, really. And we really were flat out, because we spent every single day down somewhere. And these strange things, they were sort of turning into... I mean, they seemed to be sort of planting a lot of railway sleepers, which we couldn't make out what for, but no doubt we would find out all over the sort of... between an area between sort of Gravesend and... or Red Hill, really. But we had no idea what it was for. Anyway, we had no leave, but we were really getting very tired. I did manage to play some badminton and stuff, let off steam, but they just really, I mean, we had evenings off, but we weren't allowed to go away from the camp for any length of time other than just an evening off. And you do get very tired, you know, when you're sort of doing that for no respite.
Did you hitchhike around this time?
No, I never hitchhiked very much. I wasn't a great hitchhiker, I don't think. I used to pick up hitchhikers. In those days, you could pick up people because everybody was in uniform. And, I mean, nowadays, I wouldn't pick up anybody, but then you all picked up somebody. But I wasn't a great hitchhiker. I used to, if I went down to Virginia Water and I didn't go on my machine, I used to go down by bus to Waterloo and then catch a train down to Virginia Water. It seemed easier, really. In April of 1944, my cousin, who was in the Navy, was summoned to Buckingham Palace to receive his DSC. And the family were allowed to go in with him, his mother and his father, but his father, my uncle, kindly invited me down to lunch for a celebration afterwards. So I rushed off and got permission and thought I'd better make myself really smart, so off I went and ironed everything and polished everything. And he got his medal, and then we went off and had a lovely lunch. And there's a nice picture of us all standing outside the Victoria Memorial with his medal. And unfortunately, I never got to see Buckingham Palace inside, but at least he got his medal, which is a good thing. My uncle complimented me on my smartness, which was something he didn't often do, so it went very well for once.
What happened for you around just before D-Day? What sort of duties did you have?
Well, we really were sort of, if you were on night duty, you were whizzing up and down the fighter command, which wasn't very far, actually, about 2 miles up the road with dispatches and stuff, because all the commands were sort of allied to each other, and the fighter command was at Bentley Priory in Stanmore. And but it really was sort of non-stop whizzing about. I'm not sure that you needed to. We went into London a lot to Air Ministry and that. But it wasn't. There were also the long journeys every day to balloon sites to see what was coming on. And we still didn't know what the railway sleepers were for, but I'm sure we were going to find out shortly. And on the night of June the 5th, I was actually on duty, and there was a lot of excitement about, because everybody seemed to know that something was going to happen. And I had a trip into London, and then I had to go up, take a dispatch up to the fighter command. And on the way to fighter command was a pub which we all used a lot. That Langwood was very good, and he was a great friend of us all. And I thought, I'll call in on my home. I seemed to need a drink, so I popped in there, and he gave me half a lager, I think, or whatever it was, half a beer, I suppose. And I went back to the MT hut where I was doing my night duty. And then, so in the early morning, the CO rang up. All the officers were hanging about, so obviously something was going on. And he rang and said that the D-Day landings had started. So I thought, well, let's go and see him. So off I went, and we all had a swig of rather warm champagne, but at least things had started moving now, which was a good thing.
When you were carrying out your dispatches, can you remember the vehicle you were driving?
Oh, well, normally all the vehicle, but most of the time I drove, was a Hillman Minx saloon, because they were used for everything, practically. They were lovely little cars. And we had two motorcyclists, who did the sort of other stuff, but all our cars were these little Hillman Minxes, except for we had a lorry for collecting food and stuff from the big camp, which we had to go and get, and also we had a dilapidated old Hillman, it was an Austin van or something, which nobody liked to drive. But other than that, and the CO had a very nice commandeered Buick, black Buick, which he shot around in, which was very nice to drive, except it had handlebar gear changes, which were awful.
During this time, was there any restrictions on alcohol, the amount of alcohol you...
Well, there were no restrictions, because you couldn't get it, really.
Right.
There was a tremendous shortage, and we couldn't afford it, actually. I mean, the officers had plenty of gin in their mess and stuff, but there was no restriction on, there was no breathalysing on the roads. But I don't think you really needed it, because nobody could get enough, you know. Mm.
Following D-Day, what happened for you then?
Well, after the sort of actual D-Day, we sort of were able to catch up on a bit of sleep for the first few days. But it wasn't long, about a week after D-Day, there was a most enormous crash in the middle of the night. And everybody leapt up and with all sorts of ideas, whatever it was. And then was another crash. Anyway, but that morning came, we had all sorts of stories. It turned out to be Hitler's V1 rocket, which was his latest affair. And it was a horrible little thing. It was like a sort of miniature plane with flames spurting out at the back, but making the most dreadful noise. And once the flame went out, the thing dived into the ground with a tremendous amount of explosive in it. It was known always as a doodlebug, I think. But then, of course, there were real panic stations all around, and we then, of course, discovered what the railway sleepers were. They were to be anchors for balloons all along the coast. So we were rushing around with balloon officers, and the balloon squadrons up north were brought down to the south, and it amazingly, in about sort of a very short time, there were 1,000 balloons flying all along the just inland from the south coast to stop these, or try and stop them, these bombs going to London. I mean, they didn't stop them, but they did. I think they brought down over 300, which is really jolly good, because they flew at all sorts of heights, and you just can't shoot all of them down, you know. They just... But they were very unpleasant, and at night particularly, when they got to Stanmore, they hadn't got much, they couldn't get much further, so if they got to Stanmore and you heard them, you knew they were going to come very soon, coming down from the ground. Considering the amount of trips we had down to what was known as Doodlebug Alley, which was all the Kent and Sussex coasts, we had remarkably few casualties. I had one close encounter with a bomb. We were coming back from somewhere on the south coast and going along quite happily back to camp round Doodlebug Alley. It was round about the sort of Lewisham area, and suddenly sort of everybody's looking up, because you couldn't really hear them if you were in the car, and everybody looking up and sort of running, so we thought there must be something happening. Anyway, before we could sort of do anything, one bomb came down just in front of us. I mean, not literally, but I mean quite near enough. And luckily, most of the blast went the other way, but sufficient came to blow us into a tree. And I had suffered from an enormous black eye and bruises and some knocked out front teeth. And the officer had a broken nose, but really we were very lucky. If the blast had come the other way, it would have been curtains for us, I'm sure. But the people were very helpful. They got the little car back on the road, and it seemed to go, so we limped home with a sort of battered front car, battered driver, battered officer, and all was well. But it was unpleasant too, because you never know when the things were going to, which way they were going to explode. This was the trouble.
What sort of injuries did you sustain?
Well, I did had my two front teeth knocked out, and I had an enormous black eye. And that was quite funny, because I had to wear a patch over one eye for a few days, and just after it had happened, I had a day off, so I went down into London, because all of us overseas people used to meet at the overseas club in London, and quite often you met somebody you knew. And just as I walked into this club, there was this patch on my eye and sort of everything, a voice sort of from the bar said, "Mrs. Nelson, I presume." And it was a cousin of mine I hadn't seen for about 8 years. So we had long chat. But basically, we none of us suffered very much in the way of, I mean, we got the odd bruise, but we had a lot of trouble with punctures and things because of broken glass and everything. And particularly when the V2 started, because you couldn't hear them coming.